Omaha Public Radio presents another program from Creighton University on Noon Forum. We'll hear the 20th Annual Women in Health Lecture presented by the Creighton University Center for Health Policy and Ethics. The guest speaker will be Barbara Dolinsky, author of Uplift, Secrets from the Sisterhood of Breast Cancer Survivors, The Secret Between Us, and most recently, While My Sister Sleeps. She'll speak on the topic, Family Crises and Other Little Bumps in Life. This program was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Wednesday evening, October 7, 2009, for broadcast at this time. The opinions expressed are those of the speaker and do not necessarily represent those of Creighton University, KIOS-FM, or the Omaha Public School District. Here now to introduce the speaker is Amy Haddad, Director of the Center for Health Policy and Ethics and holder of the C.C. and Mabel L. Chris Endowed Chair in the Health Sciences at Creighton University.
Ms. Dolinsky is the author of numerous books, the newest of which actually isn't While My Sister Sleeps, because there's one coming out soon that she will tell us about. She was born and raised in Boston and earned a B.A. in psychology at Tufts University and an M.A. in sociology at Boston College. Barbara and her husband Steve live in Needham, Massachusetts, and have two sons. A breast cancer survivor, Ms. Dolinsky compiled the book Uplift, Secrets from the Sisterhood of Breast Cancer Survivors. The sale of Uplift has allowed the Barbara Dolinsky Charitable Foundation to fund research fellowships at Massachusetts General Hospital. Barbara describes herself as an everyday woman writing about everyday people facing not-so-everyday challenges. Her lecture tonight is entitled Family Crises and Other Little Bumps in Life. We are most pleased that she is here with us this evening. Please join me in welcoming her.
Thank you so much, Dr. Haddad, for that wonderful introduction. And I would like at the start to thank the Center for Health Policy and Ethics for inviting me here. It's always difficult for me to hear kind words spoken in an introduction at events like this. Okay, I mean, part of that is the female thing wherein we don't feel that we deserve the praise. But I'm even more of a fraud. I mean, what kind of person spends her free time dreaming up scenarios where bad things happen to good people? Isn't there enough grief in real life as it is? And yet, several summers ago, while I was looking for an idea for the book that would eventually become While My Sister Sleeps, I sat on a dock at the lake wearing my flip-flops and sipping my latte and asking myself, what event would knock a family out cold? Well, one of its members being suddenly irrevocably on life support would. My mind got going on that. A massive heart attack would do it, I decided. And if the victim was only 32? That'd be a shocker. But what if she's a runner? Better still, what if she's an elite marathoner headed for the Olympics? What if she's the absolute star of her family? Oh my gosh, what if she is the gravitational force around which that entire family revolves? What if this family has never, ever discussed end-of-life issues such that they have no idea what to do? I mean, see how bad I am? But I'm getting ahead of myself. Let me back up a bit. Writing about bad things is my niche. I write about family crises that result from sibling rivalry or marital angst or illness, infidelity, or even infertility. I write about situations in which the unexpected happens, like when a black baby is born to a white couple. And I write about these things because I'm interested. And because if I'm interested, I figure that my readers will be too, since I am my quintessential reader. I want to know how people handle crises. Do they run away? Are they paralyzed? Do they use these crises as a vehicle for growth? My agent calls this domestic drama. I call it reality. I create real people who have real friends and real family. My characters are very much like you and me and the people we know. I build a history for them, so that their personalities ring true. And I do this not as a trained psychologist, but as a professional people watcher. I do believe that we are shaped by the events in our lives. My characters certainly are, and that's how I build a story. But it's also how I am. I'd like to tell you a little bit about that, a little bit about how I got to this place, to this podium. I really am an accidental writer. I had no plans to be one, a writer at all. My one experience in honors English in high school ended abruptly when I just couldn't keep up with the rest of the class and was asked to leave. That teacher I would love to talk with now, but she's no longer here, bless her soul. I had never met an author back then. I wasn't even an avid reader. I was a psychology major in college. If I took any English courses, I cannot remember what they were. I got a master's degree in sociology and worked for several years before my husband and I decided to start a family. And for 10 years then, I was a full-time mom with three active little boys. When it came time for my youngest, the twins, to start school, I began applying for jobs in my field. And for lack of a better option, because I really needed to work, we needed the money, I was close to accepting one of those jobs when, by chance, one morning I read an article in my local paper, the Boston Globe, about three women who wrote category romances. Do you all know what they are? I did not at the time. We're talking the Harlequin-type romance. I had never read one, but these women made it sound easy, and I just want to say here, it is not easy. Women who write category romances work so hard. The analogy I make often is to soap opera actors who have to work every day of the week, every week of the year. It's not like doing a movie for 3 months or whatever. Women who write, mainly women, category romance, have to write at least four books and get their name out there at least four times a year in order to make a name for themselves. Anyway, getting back to the article that I read, one of the women was putting her husband through law school, and another was raising three kids while she was writing. This seemed very, very doable to me. I had nothing to lose by trying, right? That newspaper article appeared in November of 1979. I spent the next 2 months reading 30 to 40 of these books, and I spent the month after that writing one, and lo and behold, it sold. So think about it. I had accidentally opened the newspaper to that article and then proceeded by chance to get the right product to the right person in New York. The truth, of course, was that I was flying by the seat of my pants. If any step had gone differently, I would not have this career. People say that I was born with a talent, but I'd like to break that down. As I see it, writing consists of an art and a craft. The craft of writing, as I learned in my non-honors English in high school, is the art of putting the craft of putting sentences together in a way that is meaningful, that makes your sentence say something. This is what I learned in school. The art, the heart, really, is what I learned in life. But life is never smooth. We all experience bumps, hence the title of this talk, Family Crises and Other Little Bumps in Life. This is what I write about, and I write from experience. Just as my characters have had to deal with bumps, so have you all, I would warrant, and so have I. I lost my mother when I was 8. It was the single most life-changing experience that I've had, and it totally shaped my character. Think about it. Having to do things for myself, I became self-reliant. I became independent. In time, I also became self-confident because I was surviving without a mother. When you do that at such a young age, you come to believe you can do anything, like write a book. But I repeat what I said earlier. I do believe that we are shaped by the events in our lives. Losing a mother so young opened my eyes to the world. Life was no longer a fairy tale. Death became very real to me. Accepting this gave me a sensitivity to others, whether their problem was the loss of a parent or something else entirely. It gave me insight into family dynamics, though, of course, I had no idea at that age what family dynamics meant. But I did know that was what was happening in my family was unusual for the time in which I was living. Back then, this is in the early 50s, there weren't as many one-parent families. In fact, I was the only kid in my class who didn't have two parents. And there were repercussions in our house of having only one parent. For my sisters, repercussions for my sisters and me, some good, some bad. One of the good ones was actually this. After my mother died, I was sent off to sleepaway camp. My dad needed us to be busy for the summer, and he couldn't do it. They were very happy times for me because, of course, when you're away at sleepaway camp, everybody is without parents. So I fit in very well. For 7 summers running, through 8 weeks of bunking in a cabin with a dozen girls my age, I emerged as a kind of confidant to the others. I could listen and I could understand. I gravitated to psychology in college because it was comfortable for me, partly because of that summer experience. But by the time I read that article in the Boston Globe in 1979, I was 34 and was experiencing a mini crisis of sorts. Psychology as a profession didn't grab me. I had no idea what I wanted to do with the rest of my life. Selling that first book was a godsend. My dad, bless him, was a product of the Great Depression. I hadn't told him I was writing the book until I finished, and then I told him about it, and he was very cautious. His response when I said the book had sold was, "Could be a fluke." He was, by the way, after I had written quite a few books, he was extraordinarily proud and used to ride on the trolley into Boston from his apartment every day and home, holding my books out so everyone could see. It was really very sweet. He's been gone for 20 years, unfortunately, and never really lived to see me certainly hit the New York Times list, and that makes me sad. But it was really a shock to him, that first book that did sell. I was already halfway through my second book when the first one was bought, and I was having a ball. I mean, here was a career that fit me perfectly. I could combine my feel for people with a vivid imagination. I could be in exotic countries at a time when my husband and I didn't have the money to travel to a different state, let alone different country. And I could work from home. Years later, when my sons were in college and graduate school in different states, all 3 of them used to call me within minutes of each other. Sometimes I'd be going back and forth from one phone line to the next. And I remember saying, "You kids do this to me all the time." At which point one of them said, "Why not, Mom? It's 3:15. This was when we got home from school and you were always there." So I was lucky. That was a luxury, and not all women have that luxury. Mind you, working from home does have certain drawbacks, like friends dropping by to chat, because, after all, you're at home. Once in a while, I considered renting an office, but the cons of that were far greater than the pros. So I just kept writing at home. I got an agent. I went to writers' conferences and finally met other authors. I also met readers, several of whom told me in no uncertain terms how much more successful I'd be and how much better my books would be if I could lighten up my plots and go with a fantasy. That was when I realized that I was not the best romance writer. My books were too realistic, and I liked them that way. Increasingly, the constraints of the genre had begun to chafe. So I moved away from it. My books got longer, my characters deepened, my plots thickened. By the early 90s, I was firmly entrenched in the world of mainstream fiction. My specialty, you guessed it, family crises. This was what I knew. It was what I did best. Readers must have liked what I was now writing because my numbers grew one book to the next. But it was a slow build. I was no Oprah's book club pick. Rather, I built my audience one reader at a time. And by the way, to this day, readers mean the world to me. Anyone who writes to me gets an answer back. I mean, these are the people who have put me here. Those numbers built. They bought my books, book after book, in greater numbers until finally, in 1993, that audience was large enough to put me on the New York Times list. It happened with a book called More Than Friends. And that was the first of now 18 books to hit that list. So let's talk about those books, or in particular, about my latest, While My Sister Sleeps. I do chat with book clubs often, usually by speakerphone, and the most common question I'm asked is where I get my ideas. Most of those ideas come from the news, from a specific event like 9/11, which inspired The Summer I Dared, or the death of Princess Grace of Monaco, which inspired The Secret Between Us, or even a book called The Bridges of Madison County, do you remember that book? Which was so successful, but which I felt had a flaw that I, as a writer, wanted to correct, and which I did, for me at least, in a book called For My Daughters. In the case of While My Sister Sleeps, there was no single aha moment in its conception. As I said at the start of this talk, dreaming it up was a deliberate exercise, which isn't to say that things I'd read about in the news hadn't played a part. We've all heard about athletes with enlarged hearts. It certainly wasn't a problem unique to my book. If I wanted something to fell a 30-year-old superstar, an enlarged heart would make sense. Sadly, I was well into the writing of the book when a young man died of the same disorder during the Olympic marathon trials in New York City. Okay, so I had a topic. My publisher approved it, and I was on my way. But I quickly realized that I didn't want to write a book about death. Honestly, I didn't think I could live with that for the 9 months that it would take me to get the book finished. I needed a happier focus. So I chose Molly Snow, the 27-year-old younger sister of our stricken runner. She's really the main character of While My Sister Sleeps. Until now, Molly has lived in the shadow of her famous sister, and to some extent has felt like a second-class citizen when it comes to her mother's affection. For this reason and others, Molly has had a love-hate relationship with this sister, the runner, Robin. In fact, on the day of the heart attack, Molly has ducked out of helping her sister and has refused to bring water during Robin's 15-mile training run. Oh, yes, the plot does thicken. You can begin to think about the kind of guilt she's going to feel later. At the core of the plot, though, is Molly's coming of age, when the rest of the family's paralyzed with grief and Robin cannot tell them what she wants them to do. Molly is forced to speak for her sister, and in doing that, she finds her own voice. I did like this focus, but still, medical issues, end-of-life issues, including ending life support and organ donation, were very sensitive parts of this book. To do them right, I did extensive research. Now, let me say something here. Different states have different rules. Same with different hospitals and different organ banks. What might have happened in Nebraska or Alabama or Arizona isn't necessarily what would happen in Massachusetts, New Hampshire, or Vermont. And since my book is set in New England, I worked with medical professionals there. They helped me understand the progression that a case like the one in this book might take. We discussed both medical and psychological issues, and in the course of my writing, I went back to them with questions time and time again. That said, my book includes only a fraction of what they taught me. My readers do not want a medical treatise. They want a book that is true to life, that is focused on the characters, always the characters. The end-of-life issues are done in my book in a gentle way that I hope simply will get readers thinking. Reading groups often ask if I work from an outline. The answer, yes and no. At the start, I outline the emotional arc of each main character, because emotions really are my stock in trade. Do I outline events? Not at the start. I know my opening. In this case, I knew that Molly would receive a phone call from the hospital telling her that her sister is in the emergency room. I knew she would roll her eyes because her sister has been in the ER for a dozen little injuries over the years. I knew that Molly would procrastinate doing a number of mundane little chores at home before finally getting around to driving to the hospital. And I knew the devastating scene she would find when she arrived. So I wrote those opening pages. Then I outlined the next few chapters, in which Molly's sister worsens, Her parents return from a trip to the talk of brain death, and her brother is no help at all. I wrote these chapters, then outlined the next few. Outline as you go. That seems to be the MO that works for me. Do I know how a book will end when I start it? This is another thing readers often ask. And the answer is yes. I know how it will end. I may not know the details, who says what during that final climactic scene, or even where that final scene takes place. Nor do I necessarily know the steps in between. I know point A, I know point Z. Everything in between is a work in progress. I just whittle away at it. Literally, the book takes shape a few chapters at a time. Occasionally, I'm surprised by the things that my characters say or do. And this, by the way, is one of the best things that can happen to a writer, when the characters you create take on minds of their own. These character-driven elements can often add a whole new layer to your book. And such was the case in While My Sister Sleeps, with Molly's grandmother, Marjorie. I'm always afraid of giving away too much of the story for those of you who haven't read it, but I think this is a case where it's worth telling a little bit more. Marjorie is in a nursing home suffering from Alzheimer's disease. I didn't actually know that until Molly blurted it out, but it works perfectly with the plot. Marjorie needs her family's love, but can no longer remember their names. She is the vehicle for Molly's realization that at some point, when permanent brain damage is involved, after all the screaming and kicking is done, you have to accept what is. Perhaps this is my approach to end-of-life issues. When do we let go? Modern medicine can keep us going a whole long time, but at what point is letting go the greatest act of love? I have no definite answer, and it varies by person, by family, by situation. Another question that readers ask is whether I've personally experienced While My Sister Sleeps. Mercifully, I have not had to deal with heart issues or a loved one on life support. I do know about Alzheimer's and suspect that that's why it popped up so unexpectedly. A very dear aunt of mine suffered from this disease. I addressed the issue head on in a novel called Shades of Grace, but here it popped up again. This time it was actually inspired by Sandra Day O'Connor, the retired Supreme Court justice whose husband has Alzheimer's disease. In an interview a while back, she talked of his having a girlfriend, her husband, having a girlfriend in the care center where he lived at the time. Justice O'Connor's opinion was that since he didn't know who she was anymore, if having a girlfriend brought him even a small measure of happiness, she was okay with it. In While My Sister Sleeps, Molly's grandmother has a boyfriend, and Molly comes to accept this, thanks in part to the gracious philosophy of Justice O'Connor. So here's another weighty topic, Alzheimer's disease, another dilemma of the kind to be found in my books. How to lighten things up, how to make issues such as end-of-life ones easier to tackle. What I do in all my books is to create a little padded pocket, a place within the story where my characters can go for a break, where I as a writer can go, where my reader can go. In The Secret Between Us, a bakery played a major role. Just the smell of those sticky buns did it for me. In Family Tree, The Haven was a yarn store. And since I'm an avid knitter, almost anything in that yarn store brought me serenity. For my non-knitting readers, the appeal of that store lay in its warmth, the camaraderie of the women there, the smell of apples from the nearby orchard, and the softness and colors of the yarn. What do we have in While My Sister Sleeps? We have a greenhouse. Now, I was very privileged this noontime to speak to a group of breast cancer survivors at the Botanical Gardens here in Omaha. And I was able to walk around through those gardens shortly before my talk, and there is that same sense of peace. Molly's family, in my book, owns a plant and shrub nursery, and Molly, who is a trained horticulturalist, is the greenhouse manager. She's there every morning watering plants, picking off dead leaves, cleaning up after rabbits that have wreaked havoc during the night, and caring for the cats whose job it supposedly is to keep those rabbits out. But Molly returns to the greenhouse at other times because she's stressed and needs relief. It's a quiet place filled with scent of moist earth and living things. It's a place for her of renewal. This element of While My Sister Sleeps, by the way, is straight out of my own past. When my kids were little and I'd had it with noise and mess, I would pile them in the car, drive to our local plant nursery, put them in a stroller, and walk the aisles. I can still remember the smell of moist earth and that sense of peace. The greenhouse is only one of many heartwarming elements in While My Sister Sleeps. Another is the growth in my characters. I personally like growth. I like it in my characters, and I like it in me. I don't mind starting with a character who has problems, like Molly's mom, favoring her oldest daughter or refusing to visit her mom because her mom has a boyfriend. I don't mind that as long as in the course of the story, that character, Catherine, improves. And she does that. Another character who does, I believe, is Robin, our runner who's now on life support. At the start of the book, we see her as self-centered. She is the star up there on a pedestal, always being coddled by her family. It's actually something of a put-off. But as the story progresses, we learn that Robin has always brought Molly gifts from wherever she's running a marathon, and that she mentors young girls, would-be runners. We also learn that she has her own angst about who and what she is. She can't speak for herself, and yet she becomes a multidimensional, sympathetic character. Robin is on life support for a week, during which time her family is forced to communicate with each other. As they sit by her bedside, trying to come to terms with what's happened, they talk to each other in ways they have never done before. And in so doing, they gain a greater appreciation of each other and of life. This is Robin's gift to them, her thank you for their putting their own needs aside for her sake for so long. And by the way, I want to say that a couple of days ago, I got a note from a reader who said she was going to be here. I don't know if Rosemarie is here tonight, but she said a very similar thing. She had no idea what I was going to say here, but said that she had finished the book and talked about the gift that Robin had given the others. I find the concept of that gift pretty uplifting. But still, I worried that readers would find this book heavy. Thankfully, they did not. Reader enthusiasm has actually been, for me, the most gratifying part of this book's publication. Oh, yes, readers wrote to say that since reading my book, they've discussed end-of-life issues with their family. But even beyond that, readers related. They identified with Molly and were rooting for her. They loved the way Catherine came around. Many truly identified with Catherine, by the way, saying that they too are married to men of quiet strength. And yes, my readers cried during those times when, for better or worse, the heartstrings were tugged. Let me divert for a second on the matter of identifying with characters. Years ago, during a book tour, one of my stops was at the Cleveland State University radio station. I remember going up to the 13th floor and looking for the door I was supposed to go into, finally, after several attempts, finding it, walking in the door to the overwhelming smell of pot and the sounds of live Armenian folk music. Very beautiful, but light years away from what I was there for. When my turn at the mic came, finally, the host, who seemed totally mystified by my presence, said that he hadn't received any publicity material and, what was it that I wrote? Somehow I knew that my usual talk wouldn't work here, so I improvised. Sounding as serious, actually as academic as I could, I said that I wrote fiction that was therapeutic in that my novels serve as a role-playing tool. We read them. We identify with the character. We let that character's experience help us work out something troubling in our own lives. I was speaking off the cuff back then, but you know, it really is true. I've become more convinced of it in the years since as readers write to tell me how one book or another of mine helped them work through a problem. There was the reader who read about the estrangement of siblings in For My Daughters and used this book as a vehicle for opening a door and connecting with her estranged sister. And the reader who used Three Wishes, which is about a premature death, to reason through the death of her own loved one. And the many readers who've used The Secret Between Us to open a dialogue with their teenage kids about drinking and driving. So what about While My Sister Sleeps? Big time role playing here. I'd like to quote from some reader notes here. One reader wrote to me, "I lost my mom just 2 months ago. I am not an emotional person, but this book for me was healing in that I was able to cry with my family and even at times laugh." Another wrote, "I just finished reading While My Sister Sleeps, and I'm sitting here in tears as the second anniversary of my husband's passing approaches. The reason for this email is to thank you for two lines in your book that have helped me in this difficult healing process. The first line is, 'Letting go isn't a betrayal, but rather a sure form of love.' The second sign is, 'Let go what might have been and accept what is.' I plan," she writes, "to put both of these lines in a frame so that I can remind myself of them as needed." A third reader wrote, "I want to thank you for your realistic portrayal of a coma. The romantic element that so many fiction writers fall prey to are very painful for those of us to have watched people we love fade away. My husband fell 500 feet down a mountain and lived. After 10 horrible weeks, I was finally able to make the decision to let him go. Thank you for validating my feelings." As for identifying with Molly, here's a really sweet note. "I truly loved While My Sister Sleeps. Coming from a family with 8 brothers and sisters and being smack in the middle, so many of the feelings felt by the characters in the book rang true to my family and myself. I can relate to Molly in so many ways. She handled situations thrown her way much better than she gave herself credit for doing. I can see now that I've done that too." So readers do relate. These are only a sampling of the many notes they've written to me over the years, saying how deeply they've come to know my characters and how strongly they identify with their dilemmas. Certain issues we avoid. It's often easier to deal with these issues if we think of them in the context of fiction, dealing with other people. Thanks to the loyalty of my readers, I've reached some wonderful milestones. I have vivid memories of the day my first paperback hit the New York Times list, then the day my first hardcover hit it. I remember when I made my first sales in England, when I visited with a very large group in Italy. I remember first sales in Brazil and Japan and Romania. I remember my first People magazine review and my first and only to date appearance on the Today Show. That took 2 weeks of preparation time, by the way, and I think it occurred in the last 5-minute segment of the show and nobody saw it. So I would never prepare that much again. I don't think I'll be invited on again, but success, though, does have its price. Being a writer has changed. It isn't Hemingway's book world anymore. Writing is now a business. With each book, the stakes rise. The stress rises, the demands from the outside world rise. Hemingway did not have to deal with the internet. He didn't have to manage a website. He didn't have to blog or maintain a presence on Facebook. These things all take time. I would guess that I spend easily a third of my time on them, which of course means less time to write, which means panic and stress when a deadline approaches and a lot of burning of the midnight oil. But sadly, today it isn't enough to just write a good book. I've seen writers who are far more talented than me who've stopped writing because they couldn't handle the marketing, the publicity, the competition. Now, I do not handle competition very well, so I've developed coping mechanisms. For starters, I never go into a bookstore when I have a new book out because I may not like exactly where that book is placed. I don't read reviews on Amazon because I may read 20 good ones, but there is one bad one, even if it's anonymous, that's the one I remember and obsess about. I don't look at the bestseller list because I don't want to see who's higher than I am. Believe it or not, there are times when I actually feel relieved when my book is done with its run on those lists and the tension of holding my breath each week on Wednesday evening at 5:40, which is when the publishers get the facts from the New York Times about the newspaper 10 days from then. I'm relieved when the tension of holding my breath that day, waiting to hear, is over. Publishing can be an emotional roller coaster. Forget the economy, which has devastated so much of the book world. Think of other unanticipated hurdles, like when the editor, who is your cheerleader, who's been championing your book, is suddenly fired. Or when UPS goes on strike, just when your book is about to ship to all those bookstores from the warehouse. Or when you just happen to come out on the same day as the new Harry Potter. I have personally experienced all of those things. But they're only little bumps, that's all. I've created my own padded pockets, such as the ones you'll find in my books. What are mine? Well, I've already told you about greenhouses and yarn stores, but then there are libraries. Libraries have a special place in my heart. My mom got sick when I was 3, and she was sick for 5 years before she died. So I have very few memories of doing things with her. One is holding my hands up for her hank of yarn so that she could wind it into a ball. She was a knitter, too. The other memory I have of my mother involves the library. Sick as she was, she regularly took my sisters and me to our local branch. I remember a big yellow Victorian with very scary fire escapes on the back. But inside, oh, the insides were amazing. I remember cozy little nooks and crannies. I remember bookmarks and an assortment of colors. I don't know if this is just an East Coast thing or whether you have them here. They were kind of pebbly on the surface, and they had that little cutout tongue that you can put over a page to mark your place. I remember the smell of all those books and the sense of infinite adventure. You could go anywhere in library. Here there was safety for me and always promise and hope. Through the turmoil of my childhood, libraries were a haven. To this day, when life gets too wild, I go sit on the floor in the stacks, just me and all those books. Whenever I have a new book out, I send an e-blast to my whole mailing list to alert them. Of course, I want them to drop what they're doing and race to their nearest bookstore and buy the book. And I give them all the links where they can do that. Each time, though, I get a handful of replies saying something to the effect of, "Bummer, I'm number 305 on the list. It may take a while, but I'll get there." Sometimes they do cave in and buy the book, but here's another thing. Not only are women patient, as in waiting for a book on a library list, but they share. We buy one copy and pass it around to mothers, sisters, friends, any we can think of. I calculate, and this is my publisher's calculation too, that every book I sell is read from between 4 to 5 people. Is this true of books by men? I'm not sure. Take The Perfect Storm a while back. You remember that book? Between my husbands and sons, 4 of them, there were 3 separate copies of that book in our house. Now, granted, my husband and I encourage book buying for obvious reasons. Still, my guys were not about to wait. They wanted instant gratification, as men are sometimes wont to do. So think about that next time you look at a bestseller list with men at the top. Think about how many people are actually reading one of those books. And what would happen if women got credit for the number of people who actually read each copy rather than the number of copies sold? I would guess that the bestseller list would look a whole lot different. But please, I am not complaining. I want my books to be read by as many people as possible. That's one of the reasons I do love libraries, and I love knowing that my books can be found there. They can entertain and educate and inspire. Am I being pretentious saying this, that my books, these dreamed-up stories, actually inspire people? And yet here's more reader feedback. Barbara writes, a woman from Missouri, "I was walking by a sale in a bookstore and grabbed your book, The Summer I Dared. When I began to read, I knew somehow that it had a message for me. It does. Move on. My husband and I had been in an auto accident 6 years ago when he died, and I had all the feelings and thoughts you wrote about. I'm a professor of psychology and always wanted to live near a beach. Now I have the courage to really move there. I thank you for your sweet message that was secretly sent to encourage me. This came from a woman in Illinois. Very poignant. Hello, I just finished reading An Accidental Woman, and I wanted to thank you, Barbara, for writing such a great book. Last year, I had to have my right leg and hip amputated due to cancer. I was 23. Since then, I've been struggling to adapt to life in a wheelchair, and I haven't been doing very well at it since no one around me seems to think I'm capable of doing anything myself. Reading An Accidental Woman, which, by the way, the main character is also young and also in a wheelchair, reading An Accidental Woman made me realize that just because I'm in a wheelchair doesn't mean I have to give up on life. I can do the same things Poppy does. Now, here's a note that I just love. Dear Barbara, I'm a middle school teacher from Bainbridge, Georgia. I just wanted to write and thank you for making my life better. After many attempts to stop smoking, I tried a new tactic last summer. I quit cold turkey with one of your books in my hand. I don't know if it was fate or God's leading, because I had never heard of you until then, but every time I craved nicotine, I picked up one of your books and started reading. After 36 years of smoking, I just celebrated an entire year of being smoke-free. And then, talking of comfort, I'd like to read you one last short one. This is a note from Kuwait. I just want to thank you for being an inspiration, this woman wrote. I was a victim of sexual harassment the day before I deployed to Iraq. It has been so traumatic that I sought comfort in reading. I discovered your books and want you to know that if it was not for your novels, I would be a wreck. Your books are my lifeline at this stage in my life, and I just wanted to say thank you. Now, I share these with you because you are book people and because these notes from readers drive home the fact that books do help us through rough patches. They can make us feel good. Speaking of feeling good, I can't close without mentioning Uplift. I spoke about it at length today at lunch, but this is, after all, Breast Cancer Awareness Month, so please indulge me here. My mom died of breast cancers, and my sisters and I have all had it and live on thanks to early detection from mammography. My success really came after I was diagnosed, my success in books, at which point I needed to give back something. That need was very strong in me. So several years ago, using my fiction audience as a springboard, I compiled this piece of nonfiction, Uplift, Secrets from the Sisterhood of Breast Cancer Survivors. It is a breast cancer support group in book form and contains little secrets and uplifting anecdotes from more than 375 breast cancer survivors. And in that respect, it is still one of a kind even 8 years after its initial publication. The message here is one of hope. This is true of my novels as well because it is how I live. I can't count how many times I've told myself, you can do this. I know you can. I told myself that earlier this week when I was waking up at 3 a.m. stressing about this trip because I have a very sick cat at home. You can do this. I know you can, I said to myself repeatedly. And you know, my husband's handling her just fine. Of all of my books, Uplift has brought me the greatest joy. It is the one that I can shamelessly promote because I make no money on it. My proceeds go in their entirety into a charitable foundation that funds a research fellowship, now in its fourth year at Massachusetts General Hospital. It trains a breast surgeon in research, and that surgeon will then go on to spend 30 years, hopefully, doing research. I mean, is that awesome or what? For me, though, breast cancer was just another little bump. But speaking of bumps, I do have to mention my next book. It will be in stores January 5th, and it is about a bump. Actually, three bumps. It tells the story of three girls, high school seniors from good families, who get good grades and are headed for college until they make a pact to become pregnant. My inspiration here was the real-life talk of a pregnancy pact among high schoolers in Gloucester, Massachusetts, a year ago last June. And teen pregnancy, pregnancy pacts, has become a hot-button issue. I am not a TV watcher, but I understand that the fall lineup of shows includes several dealing with pregnant teens. My book is not just another one on that topic. The heart of my story goes beyond the girls to their moms, three women who feel the fallout, personally and professionally, from what their daughters have done. It raises the questions: are we responsible for our children's actions? Can we control everything they do? At what point did they take responsibility for their own actions? These are only a few of the questions raised by this book. The title is Not My Daughter, and it explores what it takes to be a good mother, whether that mother is 17, 40, or 65. We've got three generations in this book. Personally, I think about this a lot, about what it takes to be a good mother. My mom died when I was 45 and left three young children behind. Next summer, I will be 65. I have three grown sons, four grandchildren, and another on the way, which I said at lunch I can announce today because she is now 12 weeks pregnant. And if I had said anything before, I think that something bad would have happened. I also have the promise of more grandchildren. I've been given a chance that my mother never had, so I am determined to do it right. And to me, that means communicating. Communication is really a message that I'm sending in while my sister sleeps. Whether we're dealing with end-of-life issues, beginning-of-life issues, as in conception, or totally mundane topics, communication is key. For me, it means being there for my kids and my grandkids in ways that my mom could not be. It also means writing the best books that I possibly can, knowing that my kids and their kids are watching. They would be very proud to see you all here today. My thanks to the Center for Health Policy and Ethics here at Creighton University for inviting me to speak, and to you all for coming and hearing me out. Thank you.
You've been listening to a program from the Creighton University Lecture Series. We've heard the 20th Annual Women in Health Lecture presented by the Creighton University Center for Health Policy and Ethics. The guest speaker was Barbara Dolinsky, author of Uplift, Secrets from the Sisterhood of Breast Cancer Survivors, The Secret Between Us, and most recently, While My Sister Sleeps. She spoke on the topic, Family Crises and Other Little Bumps in Life. This program was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Wednesday evening, October 7th, 2009, for broadcast at this time. Special thanks to Cindy Workman, Associate Director of Public Relations at Creighton University, for helping to make the recording and broadcast of this program possible. Complete Noon Forum listings are available on the Internet. Visit our website at kios.org. Now, this is your producer and host, Bob Cote, thanking you for listening.